This hour's top stories. U.S. security officials say a major cyber attack on government agencies, critical infrastructure entities, and private companies poses a great risk. Iran says no separate document is necessary to revive the 2015 nuclear deal after the IAEA chief called for a new accord with Tehran. And also in the headlines, EU legislators criticize the bloc's response to the coronavirus pandemic amid lockdowns and a rising number of infections in European countries. Welcome to the program. The U.S. Cybersecurity Agency has warned of, quote, grave risk to government and private networks after hackers accessed computer systems of dozens of organizations and federal agencies. The Cybersecurity Agency says the hack has compromised federal agencies and critical infrastructure in a sophisticated attack. The Departments of Treasury, State, Defense, Energy, and Commerce are among those targeted. National Nuclear Security Administration has reportedly been hacked as well. President Donald Trump has made no official comment, but Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has blamed Russia. Moscow has denied any involvement. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has described the cybersecurity breach as a matter of great concern. He said his team would impose substantial costs on parties responsible for such attacks. Investigative journalist Max Perry believes there is no evidence that Russia has been behind a cyber attack in the U.S.
Well, you know, at the risk of sounding redundant, here we have yet another accusation coming from Washington pointed at Moscow of cyber espionage, but of course without the support of any evidence provided whatsoever. But, you know, this has been a recurring theme. But what is, I would say, is notably unique about this particular incident, or separates it from previous instances where the Kremlin has been fingered for cyber breaches, is that if you actually take a look at the cybersecurity assessment, not just the one by SolarWinds, but also by the firm FireEye, which has the U.S. government as one of its clients, their assessment given regarding this breach where malware was distributed throughout its network, its analysis does not itself identify any particular country or state actor.
In a final show of force prior to his departure, President Donald Trump has gone on a killing spree of federal death row inmates, with two executed in as many days and three more on the list prior to his handover. Is this legacy Trump? Is this the legacy Mr. Trump was or wishes to leave on his war on crime? Take a look, please.
The United States are quick to condemn other nations around the world on a whole host of issues, from political alignment to economic choices, yet it's on human rights that the US is the most hypocritical of them all, as federal inmates are being executed in a final purge prior to Trump's imminent departure. When Trump came to power, and in fact during both his election campaigns, he claimed that he would be a champion of the justice system, famously stating to Hillary Clinton during one televised debate that he would get her arrested. Yet with time ticking away before Trump hands over the reins to Joe Biden, the incumbent president appears to have gone on a federal killing spree, executing more prisoners since he's been in power than all other state executions combined, making him responsible for more executions than any other modern president. In 2020 alone, state-ordered executions totaled 7 across all 50 states of the US. Yet Trump's federal executions have totaled 10, with 3 more inmates on death row due to be terminated prior to January the 21st, something that Trump will likely see out as the deadline approaches, potentially bringing the total to 13, almost double the amount of state executions. The decision by Trump to go on a final execution spree breaks with the norm, as traditionally, death row inmates are usually exempt from execution during a presidential transition period, allowing the incoming to consider clemency should the terms and conditions apply.
I think the number that we've seen from the Trump administration is astronomical compared to what we've seen from previous administrations combined. And so, especially by adding on some on top of what was already scheduled, I think it's clear that they're trying to rush the execution process.
But it seems that Trump is merely following the age-old US tradition of using the death penalty, as since colonial times, the US has executed over 15,000 people. Many of them had been later found to be not guilty due to technological advances, criminal investigations improving, and public opposition to the death penalty increasing. Naturally, the timing of the latest execution has raised the question as to whether this is genuinely a cause for justice, or is this simply Donald Trump playing God for one last time, showing the US and the rest of the world just what kind of man he really is.
With 42% of inmates on death row from black communities, is this a racial decision by Trump to proceed with the executions? Already his handling of the BLM situation is poor, police brutality against blacks is shocking, and his views have caused huge division. Yet the Trump departure on the horizon, could the arrival of Joe Biden as president change perhaps the U.S. federal policy on execution and, more importantly, unite a deeply divided nation?
Trump has shown he's not shy when it comes to stirring racial hatred in the U.S. His mishandling of the Black Lives Matter movement was one of the key reasons he lost the presidential election to Joe Biden, leaving behind a country deeply divided along a racial line in the process. The sentiment is reflected in the U.S. criminal justice system, especially on death row, as since 1976, only 21 white defendants have been executed for crimes against black people, yet 297 black suspects have been executed in the U.S. for crimes on white people, clearly showing the system is racist to the core. Trump's also demonstrated a history of racist views, labeling the Black Lives Matter movement as a destructive entity, not designed to bring equality and justice to black people, but to bring the entire U.S. infrastructure to a halt, something that's baffling to hear.
The stated goal of BLM organization people is to achieve the destruction of the nuclear family, abolish the police, abolish prisons, abolish border security, abolish capitalism, and abolish school choice. That's what their stated goals are. This is not the agenda of the black community. This is the agenda of an extreme socialist, or worse, you know what the other word is, yeah, Marxist, communist.
With Trump supporters clearly echoing the sentiments of the outgoing president, groups such as the Proud Boys and other far-right organizations are lapping up the attention and openly supporting a crackdown on black people, either through the use of police brutality or through the execution chamber, something that the U.S. has a haunting history on when it comes to killing black people. Yet the situation may be about to change in the U.S., with President-elect Joe Biden stating that he is in fact against the death penalty, and should the conditions be met, he can end the act with a stroke of a pen. However, Biden, like many others before him, still has a lot to demonstrate that he can turn his words into actions.
Quote, you won't be saving Joe Biden's America. And what's their proof? The violence we're seeing in Donald Trump's America. These are not images of some imagined Joe Biden America in the future. These are images of Donald Trump's America today.
What now remains to be seen is whether Trump's last stand will be to execute the three remaining federal prisoners prior to him leaving, and more importantly, whether the U.S. now, and in the future, considers its own actions before criticizing others.
Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organization says no separate document is necessary to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. In a series of tweets, Qasem Gharibabadi reiterated that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is not subject to renegotiation. He also said under the accord, the International Atomic Energy Agency is tasked with only monitoring and verifying Iran's voluntary measures, and not making assessments on how Tehran is implementing its commitments. He was responding to comments by IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi, who argued the upcoming U.S. administration needs to strike a new deal with Iran due to the occurrence of what he called too many breaches. The U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, announced a gradual scaleback of its commitments, citing the remaining signatories' failure to uphold their obligations. Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations says his country is committed to bringing about peace, stability, and development in Afghanistan.
Iran and Afghanistan enjoy common religious, cultural, linguistic, and historical backgrounds, and our stability, social, cultural development, and economic growth are intertwined and mutually reinforced.
Takht-e Ravanchi was speaking at a Security Council meeting on Afghanistan. He said the decades-long insecurity there can end only through a comprehensive and inclusive peace process. Iranian envoy said Afghanistan's neighbors are well, as well as regional and international partners, that is, should support the process as well. Takht-e Ravanchi called on Taliban militants to halt their attacks in order for the peace process to go ahead. He also said the presence of foreign forces is one of the sources of instability in Afghanistan. An Afghan Taliban delegation led by its political chief visits Pakistan to discuss peace efforts. The visit comes as there is a 20-day break in the intra-Afghan dialogue, which has so far made little headway on the future of Afghanistan. Kamran Youssef has more.
The Afghan Taliban delegation is in Pakistan to discuss the peace efforts. The delegation is headed by Mullah Brother, the head of Taliban's political office in Doha. The visit comes after Taliban and Afghan government took a 20-day break in their talks taking place in Doha. After months of negotiations, the two sides recently agreed on the rules of engagement. But there is no progress on the comprehensive ceasefire, as Taliban have linked the truce with peace deal. But the Pakistan's foreign minister, who also met the Taliban leaders, said Taliban have shown their readiness to seek an end to the war.
Taliban are convinced that the continuation of war is neither in their interest nor in the interest of Afghanistan. I get the feeling after my negotiations with the Taliban that they are serious to end this conflict, which is very encouraging.
Afghan Taliban and the U.S. signed a landmark deal in February this year. The deal outlines a roadmap for the U.S. troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan. In return, Taliban agreed not to allow Afghan soil to be used again by terrorist groups. Given Pakistan's historic ties with the Taliban, the U.S. and Afghan government expect Islamabad to ensure that the Taliban live up to their commitment.
Pakistan is in a position to use its lever, but it will not, I think. It will just facilitate. It will try, as Foreign Minister Qureshi has said in this event, that Pakistan will try to let the Afghan. There will be no imposition of any process on Afghan.
At the moment, all eyes are on the incoming U.S. president as to whether he will follow the same policy on Afghanistan or take a different course.
On paper, there seems no change in the policy of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden with regard to Afghanistan, but he may not hasten the troops' withdrawal as sought by President Trump. This means the situation in Afghanistan will remain uncertain, at least in the foreseeable future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
China has urged the United States to stop what it called the unjustified crackdown on Chinese companies. China says it will continue to take necessary measures to ensure its companies' legitimate rights and interests. The reaction followed a Reuters report that Washington is poised to add dozens of Chinese companies to a trade blacklist. The report, citing two people familiar with the matter, said the companies include China's top chipmaker, SMIC. The news agency said companies that the U.S. accuses of having ties with the Chinese military are on the list as well. The administration of President Donald Trump has prepared a so-called entity list that hits key Chinese industries. The U.S. military says its warships will be more assertive in response to what it calls violations of international law. The Pentagon made the announcement in a document setting objectives for the U.S. Navy for the coming years. The document mentions several countries, particularly China and Russia. It accuses them of growing aggressiveness and contesting the balance of power in key regions. The document also describes China as the most pressing long-term strategic threat. The Pentagon says in response to that that it will accept more calculated tactical risks. The U.S. and China are at odds, that is, over Beijing's territorial claim of all the islands in the South. China Sea, Beijing accuses Washington of interfering in that region. EU legislators criticize the bloc's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. A debate has just taken place in the European Parliament, focusing on the EU's vaccine strategy. Jerome Hughes reports.
As thousands of people continue to die each and every day in the EU from COVID-19, a great deal of focus is on the issue of vaccines. The subject has just been debated by EU lawmakers.
Le campagne vaccinali sono
Inoculation campaigns began in the UK, the US, Russia and China. The European Union, what was it doing? It's been behind schedule again, waiting for some sort of green light from the European Medicines Agency. Same thing with managing the pandemic. The EU worked very badly. Nations had to go it alone.
We are told that the European Medicines Agency, which authorizes vaccines on behalf of the 27-nation EU, will give the go-ahead next week for use of the Pfizer-BioNTech jab. The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted that vaccination will start across the EU on December 27th, 28th and 29th. However, there is concern that nations are not prepared. Apparently, many EU countries have not yet submitted their vaccination plans to the Commission. EU authorities insist the process cannot be rushed.
Safety of vaccines.
We have been speaking to citizens.
We have to take care of getting this herd immunity through the vaccine. So it is key for our Western states to get there now, given that we're almost in the third wave, I think.
I just think that I will not get the vaccines for myself too early. I just want to wait a little bit to see if there are the secondary effects, bad effects on people.
Lawmakers are expressing outrage that the European Commission is resisting calls to share the formula of proven vaccines with developing nations on the basis that it would stifle investment into vaccine research.
I urge the Commission to rethink their position and to show the world that saving lives is more important than saving an outdated model of intellectual property rights. Access to medicine for all is a human right.
On the economic front, all sides agree that developing a successful vaccine strategy is crucial to preventing the EU from being rendered completely bankrupt. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians appraise the move by EU lawmakers to call for a ban on goods produced by Israeli settlers. They also hope the move could serve as a platform for new economic measures against the Israeli regime. Mona Candil now reports.
A new report says at least 40 European Parliament's lawmakers from 14 member states signed a petition demanding that products from Israeli settlements be banned by the bloc. According to Palestine Embassy in Brussels, the petition calls for the application of European law and World Trade Organization law to prevent Israeli settlements' products from entering into the EU's markets. BDS, anti-Israel movement promoting boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against Israel, praised the move and hoped for further measures against the occupying regime. Many European Union nations decided to only label imported Israeli products that are produced in settlements in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and in the Golan Heights. Palestinian experts say barring goods produced in illegal settlements from entering into the EU markets will serve as a heavy blow to Israel, mainly because settlement goods are exported directly to European markets. Boycotting of Israeli products around the world has been growing rapidly in recent years and caused heavy losses to Israeli companies. Thousands of volunteers, trade unions, NGOs, academic and business societies, as well as cultural figures worldwide, have joined the boycott campaign to help promote the Palestinian cause. Most European countries don't deal with settlement products in the same way as Israeli products. They don't label them as being produced in Israel. But the most important for the Palestinians would be when the EU prohibits import and sale of goods, services, and natural resources originating from illegal Israeli settlements. Mona Kandib, Occupy Ramallah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Maruh
هدایت میکنه.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و اونگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی.
And trying to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیبه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزای لازمی است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 15 of Surah Jathiyah.
من عمل صالحا فلنفسه ومن أساء فعليها ثم إلى ربكم ترجعون.
Whoever acts righteously, it is for his own soul, and whoever does evil, it is to its own detriment. Then you will be brought back to your Lord. If you remember, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said God has made the entire universe subservient to mankind, so that We use it in a proper manner and express gratitude to Him through contemplation on these great bounties, instead of being thankless or misusing these favors to bring destruction upon others and eventually upon our own selves. Thus, divine punishment or reward is in accordance with one's own deeds. The ayah that we recited to you now means to say that the fruits of any deed, whether sweet or bitter, will determine the eventual fate of the doer on the day of judgment. In other words, divine reward or punishment is just and in accordance with a person's good or evil deeds. At times, those who fail to understand divine wisdom ask whether God Almighty gains or loses anything as a result of the obedience or disobedience of any person. The answer is obvious. A teacher always tells the students to listen attentively to lessons and study well in order to pass, and that too with destination marks. But if some of the students were to fail because of their scant regard to the lessons taught by the teacher and refusal to do homework, their failure will not harm sympathetic teacher at all. Thus, if we strive towards perfection through our good deeds, by avoiding the pitfalls, we will certainly be rewarded by the all-merciful Lord. As for those who indulge in sins and unbelief to end up in everlasting damnation, the fault is their own, and they have deprived themselves of divine mercy. This ayah teaches us that, number one, the all-merciful Lord is just and rewards the virtuous for their good deeds and is ready to forgive those who sincerely repent and turn to Him for forgiveness in the transient life of the mortal world, while those who didn't and died in the state of unbelief and sins will be punished in accordance with the degree of their evil deeds. And number two, the Almighty Creator is too glorious to either benefit or be harmed by our good or evil deeds. Now let us listen to ayahs 16 and 17 of the same surah.
وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ الْكِتَابَ وَالْحُكْمَ وَالنُّبُوَّةَ وَرَزَقْنَاهُمْ مِنَ الطَّيِّبَاتِ وَفَضَّلْنَاهُمْ عَلَى الْعَالَمِينَ وآتيناهم بينات من الأمر فما اختلفوا إلا من بعد ما جاءهم العلم بغيا بينهم إن ربك يقضي بينهم يوم القيامة فيما كانوا فيه يختلفون.
Certainly, we gave the children of Israel the book, judgment, and prophethood, and we provided them with all the good things, and we gave them an advantage over all the nations, and we gave them manifest precepts. But they did not differ except after knowledge had come to them, out of envy among themselves. Indeed, your Lord will judge between them on the day of resurrection, concerning that about which they used to differ. These ayahs refer to the ancient Israelites who were descended from the 12 sons of Prophet Jacob, who was also called Israel. Prophets were raised amongst them, and heavenly scriptures revealed for their guidance as part of the mercy shown to them by God Almighty in spite of their disobedience, since they were at least monotheists compared to nations immersed in idol worship. Yet, they failed to benefit from the divine favors. As a result of their wrongdoing, ingratitude, and indulgence in sins, their exalted station turned into humility and damnation. It is reported that over 1,000 prophets were appointed for their guidance between the missions of prophets Moses and Jesus, peace upon them, but instead of heeding the words of God, they conspired against the prophets, persecuted them, and killed many of them. The worst form of unbelief is to differ in matters of truth when God Almighty had granted knowledge and manifest precepts, as Isaiah 17 points out. Among other things, these evident proofs refer to the coming of the last and greatest prophets amongst the Ishmaelite Arabs with the universal message of Islam, as mentioned clearly in the Torah and other scriptures. This is a clear reference to the mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Yet, the Israelites, despite enjoying such favors, became envious, disobeyed God, and deliberately ignored the message of the Prophet of Islam by resorting to illogical and irrational arguments, for which God will judge between them on the day of resurrection and mete out the punishment they deserve. These ayahs also serve as a warning to the Muslims against indulging in the same thankless attitude towards divine favors as the Israelites did, and refusal out of jealousy to recognize the means of guidance that the Prophet had left behind in the form of the noble Quran and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, the source of all blessings, whether material or spiritual, is God, and we should use them in the proper manner for our own salvation. Number two, religious teachings and a state rule do not contradict each other, and as a matter of fact, politics ought to be based on religious principles, unlike the Western Zionist propaganda of separation between religion and state. Number three, God has sealed his argument through clear proofs that enable us to recognize and understand the manifest truth of which we will be questioned on the day of judgment. And number four, awareness and recognition are not enough for salvation, since there are many who recognize the truth but stir up sedition and discord in the society out of envy and disobedience of God, as the Israelites did. Here are ayahs 18, 19, and 20 of Surah Jathiyah.
ثُمَّ جَعَلْنَاكَ عَلَى شَرِيعَةٍ مِّنَ الْأَمْرِ فَاتَّبِعْهَا وَلَا تَتَّبِعْ أَهْوَاءَ الَّذِينَ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ إِنَّهُمْ لَنْ يُغْنُوا عَنْكَ مِنَ اللَّهِ شَيْئًا وَإِنَّ الظَّالِمِينَ بَعْضُهُمْ أَوْلِيَاءُ بَعْضٍ وَاللَّهُ وَلِيُّ الْمُتَّقِينَ هَذَا بَصَائِرُ لِلنَّاسِ وَهُدًى وَرَحْمَةٌ لِقَوْمٍ يُوقِنُونَ
Then we set you upon a clear course of the law, so follow it, and do not follow the desires of those who do not know. Indeed, they will not avail you in any way against Allah. Indeed, the wrongdoers are allies of one another, but Allah is the guardian of the God-weary. These are eye-openers for mankind, and guidance and mercy for a people who have certitude. Here, the address is to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. God placed him on the clear path of divine law. It is the path of piety, which means that whoever is responsible for guiding the people ought to be fully aware of the Prophet's Sharia and diligently adhere to it. The word Sharia is applied to a waterway leading to a river, but in common usage, it denotes the path of prophets, which culminates in the Islamic Sharia, Since the Noble Quran is the final heavenly scripture revealed to the last and greatest prophet. Thus, the prophet of Islam upon divine commandment does not take into consideration the desires of the ignorant, since he is vested with the ultimate truth that will remain till the end of the world. To be more precise, God has designated the straight and unwavering path of Islam, to which the prophet firmly adheres and invites mankind to it by rejecting the idea of compromise on the principles of religion with any of the disbelievers, whether it is the Arab polytheists or the Israelites who might attempt to distort faith. As the next ayah says, these deviant elements who are accomplices of each other in the vain bid to prevent the spread of Islam will never succeed, since God, the Omnipotent, is the guardian of the pious. Thus, these disbelievers can neither stop the disasters and afflictions in this world, nor can save themselves and their followers from divine wrath on the Day of Judgment. Ayah 20 means to say that piety serves as the basis of insight, while the proper understanding of the Noble Quran acts as the eye-opener, providing insight in all intellectual, ethical, political, social, economic, and family matters. Firstly, the Noble Quran is vision. In the same manner as the eyes of our head makes the seeing of objects and colors possible, the Noble Quran is the eye of the heart through which knowledge finds its way to the heart, illuminating it and showing the path of deliverance from the shadows of ignorance to the light of knowledge and wisdom. Secondly, the Noble Quran is the guidance toward the path of felicity in the world and salvation in afterlife. Thirdly, the Noble Quran is divine mercy bestowed upon the true believers who diligently follow its injunctions and instructions with certitude. From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number one, Islam is culmination of the messages preached by the prophets of the past, reaching perfection through the universal mission revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Number two, it is piety that makes a person deserving of divine protection, and one of the characteristics of the pious is their abstaining from the goals and desires of the ignorant and deviated elements. Number three, faith is based on insight and awareness in order to guide others with certitude. And number four, the Noble Quran is the source of insight and knowledge in all ideological, ethical, social, political, and family matters.
The debate.
Welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. The Syrian envoy to the United Nations has criticized the Security Council being used as a tool to serve Western countries' political agenda. Bashar al-Jaafari slammed what it called the Council's inaction against occupation of Syrian territory. He called Washington and Ankara as occupiers of northern Syria. The Iranian UN envoy has also warned of Washington's secret agenda in Syria, urging U.S. forces to evacuate. He also condemned the U.S. unilateral sanctions on Damascus. Now, let's go to Syria. Our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, is there for us. Let's see what he has for us. Mohammed, over to you.
Yes, Syria's permanent representative at the United Nations, Dr. Bashar al-Jafari, said in his latest word before the UN Security Council, he actually focused that word on what he described as the UN Security Council's failure for decades in addressing many issues that threaten international peace and security in the region and in the world, mainly the Israeli occupation of Arab lands in Palestine, Syria, and Lebanon, the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq, and NATO's destruction of Libya. Now, regarding Syria, al-Jafari said that after 10 years of the UN Security Council's intervention in discussing the situation in Syria, he said, and I quote, "We still see U.S. occupation in northeastern Syria, U.S. support to terrorist groups and separatist militias, meaning the so-called SDF, as well as U.S. occupation of Al-Tan area and Al-Rukban camp, in addition to the U.S. Support to Daesh and the so-called Maghawir al-Thawra terrorist groups." He also noted that there is still Turkish occupation in areas in northwestern Syria, and that whereas Turkey there supports and recruits mercenaries, using them, as he described, in the market of international wars. He also said that we still witness Turkey's war crimes against Syrians, such as killings, displacement, looting, and depriving Syrians of drinking water. Al-Jafari also stressed that, in addition to all that, in southern Syria, we also continue to see the Israeli occupation. Al-Jafari made it clear that Western member states of the UN Security Council did not do anything to enable that council to fulfill its commitments and tasks to end the U.S., Israeli, and Turkish occupation of Syrian lands, and that all those Western states did was that they only fueled the crisis in Syria, prolonged it, and further complicated it, turning the council into a tool in service of their political agendas.
All right, thank you for that. Mohammed Ali, correspondent in Damascus, Syria. Let me invite to author and activist with International Action Center, Sarah Flounders from New York. Good to have you with us, ma'am. The United States and Turkey have not been invited by the Damascus government to go to Syria, and Damascus regards their presence as illegal in occupation. What's the U.S. doing there?
Well, the U.S. from the very beginning has been attempting a regime change operation, in other words, a completely illegal pull down of the Syrian elected government and a destruction of Syria. They have really sought, since 2003, there have been U.S. sanctions on Syria, and beginning now, it's going into the 10th year, U.S. intervention through mercenary forces, through bombings, through troops of occupation, every effort to overturn the government of Syria. And it is a criminal operation, every single aspect of it.
Okay, now from London, I'm also joined by Secretary General of the Next Century Foundation, William Morris. William, the Pentagon says that U.S. forces are protecting the fields and facilities from possible Daesh attacks, ignoring what President Trump said a bit before that, that Washington was seeking economic interest in controlling Syrian oil fields. Let's have your take.
Well, the U.S. is scarcely relevant with regard to Syria now, is it? I mean, it has very little role. The problem more is to do with, I suppose its main role is in imposing sanctions. Its troops are down to minimum. They're over by the Iraq border. The real worry is Turkey and Turkey's incursions. Turkey is the big beast as far as Syria is concerned. It's causing a lot of problems, and particular problems for the people of northern Syria. Of course, Idlib is miserable. That whole area is miserable and living in misery. And because there is this problem between Turkey, Syria, and the Islamist fighters that are there, many of whom are, of course, backed by Turkey and supported by Turkey. There are big problems within northern Syria, and I presume that there will be a major onslaught by the Syrian government to try and clean up Idlib before the presidential elections next. Well, they're delayed, I think, from May to June. But anyway, next June, if that's when they're held. Meanwhile, the fiasco of the negotiations in Geneva over a putative constitution rumble on with everybody spiking it. It really is a joke, the UN-sponsored negotiations in Geneva. The Syrian government delays everything as best it can, and meanwhile the rump members of the opposition in Geneva that are representing the Syrian opposition, and they scarcely represent anything, are too busy drinking booze and caviar, eating caviar and living it up, and they run, the discussions go on and on and on, and they have another round and another round. There'll be another round. They'll get nowhere, and they'll be irrelevant. So that's a particular joke. But no, in many ways, Syria is much stabler. The main part of Syria, if you discount the extreme north, is stable and is doing quite well. You have these ridiculous Israeli air raids, which are just Israel trying to score points while Trump is still president, because they realize they'll have to be a little quieter, perhaps, with the incoming U.S. president, who may not have the same, may not give them the same carte blanche as Trump did. But no, things in Syria, if you discount the north and if you discount these stupid, pointless air raids by, there was one recently just south of Damascus on allegedly on some Iranian troops, allegedly in response to an attempt to break through the border fence on the Golan. I mean, if there was an attempt to break through the border fence by some Golanis, they get so many, they have such a miserable time. They're divided by that border fence, aren't they? So they have that, yeah. Sadness, and I'm sure there might have been some incident, but it's kind of irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's just an excuse. Sorry, enough. But that's my take on the situation at present.
Okay. Now, of course, we're discussing the northern part of Syria, where the U.S. and Turkish forces are present. Sarah, President Trump said in October last year that practically, I'm quoting him, that practically we are out of Syria. The troops are there to, quote, secure the oil. Is that what they're doing? We have reports of, you know, just last week, 30 tankers, you know, carrying crude oil to Iraq, U.S. actually forces. So are U.S. forces guarding the Syrian crude, as President Trump is claiming, or plundering Syrian resources?
Well, from the very beginning, this has been about plundering the Syrian resources. And could they completely overturn, collapse the government, set up their own government? That was the aim. That aim did not succeed, because the level of Syrian resistance on every measure has just been incredible. 10 years of the most difficult resistance and fighting tens of thousands of U.S. and Turkish and Saudi armed mercenaries, militias. It's really been an incredible U.S. bombing, supposedly against Daesh, ISIS forces, but really to completely destroy as much as they could of Syrian infrastructure. From the beginning, U.S. policy has been, how much damage can they do, and how much can they lay hold of in a complete act of piracy? Now, Trump was right up front in saying that U.S. interest is in the oil fields. Mm-hmm. U.S. interest has never been in the people of Syria, never been, of course, in human rights or democracy. It's been in oil and in the control. It's not that Syria wasn't making the oil available on world markets. It's that the U.S. wants to control the market and actually break up also not only Syria, but the entire region. And that is the, in every sense, the United States has played a role in how to destabilize not only Syria, but continue the occupation of Palestine, do as much damage and disorganization as they possibly can in Lebanon, continue to threaten Iran. This is U.S. policy, continue the occupation in Iraq, in northern Iraq. So the troops have been moved back and forth, in and out, along with thousands and tens of thousands of contractors and mercenaries. Every part of it, and with NATO support. Turkey is a member of NATO for 70 years and still acts with a certain level of coordination, although they have their own interests and aims in this. Also completely criminal, piracy and looting. So I think it's important to really salute the level of Syrian resistance by the government, by the people, by an organized, cohesive force that continued to feed the population of Syria, that continued to provide medical relief. In my travels to Syria, I was really amazed, impressed by the level of cohesion, even in wartime, that continued in Syria. Mm-hmm. And it's now, Syria is rebuilding in whole parts of Syria, but it's made more difficult because the sanctions continue to bite deep. They stop any country from just providing basic rebuilding material. And that's another crime. We have mm-hmm. to acknowledge that as much damage as any other country is doing, the greatest damage comes from U.S. power and coordination to try to damage Syria and continue to extract a heavy price. Now, we got a demand of this new administration. They say they're different. They got to prove it. They got to prove it to the people of the world, to the people of Syria, and right here to the people in the U.S.
Right.
If they're different, they got to act different.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, William, Sarah talked about what the U.S. is doing in northern Syria. What about Turkey now? What's Ankara's agenda behind maintaining military presence in northern Syria?
Well, I just take issue with Sarah slightly. I mean, I'm sure we agree with regard to Turkey. With regard to the United States of America, doesn't want Syria's assets. Okay, Trump may come out with lines like that, but they are so piffling. They're so small. The oil resources you're talking about are so trivial that they are really irrelevant to a world in which which is becoming fast less oil dependent. And Syria still has to depend on Iranian subsidies, and this is really not what America's policy is about. America's policy was about destabilizing Bashar al-Assad, but I don't think anybody in the world really cares that much about Syrian oil. If you're talking, the Kurds care a lot about it, and they are trying to export a little, and they've got a U.S. company buying it. And yes, the U.S., the piffling levels of troops that are left by the U.S., and the U.S. has really abandoned the Syrian Kurds and abandoned northern Syria. And the Syrian Kurds were helping them in the fight against Daesh. They left them to become victims of Turkey. And Turkey has been the brute on the block and has been quite ruthless in regard to the Syrian Kurds. So the Syrian Kurds are now seeking a kind of accommodation with Bashar al-Assad's government, and very eagerly doing so, and are being well received, and there are talks in place, and I'm sure the oil issue will be resolved between the Syrian Kurds and Bashar al-Assad's government. But but as regards Turkey, Turkey's behavior is beyond. I mean, it is so disturbing, and of course it's partly a Turkish fear. It's based on fear. This kind of, well, partly fear of their own Kurdish minority, and so they don't want to see a successful Kurdish area of northern Syria. Because it means that their own Kurdish minority will turn around and say, what about us? Mm-hmm. And they are repressed. I mean, you, many of them live under curfew. They have a very difficult time in Turkish, the Kurdish areas of Turkey. Mm-hmm. So we really have a lot to question Erdogan of Turkey about. And he is becoming an adventurist, not just in Syria, but in Libya too, and all over the place.
East Mediterranean. He's
helps him distract his own population from their own troubles, mm-hmm. if he can divert them with foreign adventures. And in a sense, that's the other reason for Turkey's involvement in northern Syria. It distracts his local population from their own troubles at home, and mm-hmm. they have a few.
Okay. Now, Sarah, do you share the Syrian UN envoy's argument? He says that the UN Security Council has turned into a tool to serve the political agenda of a number of Western states.
Well, I don't know if it's been turned into or it has always been a tool of U.S. and EU Western interests. And it has functioned both through its resolutions, through its vetoes, through its UN-imposed sanctions, in every single way has functioned against the interests of the people of the world and again against the interests of peace. And when the U.S. Policymakers are able to use the UN Security Council, they do so. And when they want to ignore it because they can't get a vote through, they ignore it. But certainly in all of this, the UN Security Council has operated with complete connivance from both Washington and from the EU. That is a real problem. And it's very important that Bashar al-Jafari raises this because he is the Syrian representative to the UN. So he speaks with great authority, knowing again and again the efforts of Syria to make their case to the UN Security Council and how it there's been a deaf ear turned consciously. Mm-hmm. Consciously. Also, just to say with the to the other speaker, I do agree that this is not just a war for oil, that Syria's oil is not of any great amount. And it is primarily a war to destabilize and to try to assert U.S. dominance in the entire region. Mm-hmm. It's because Syria also defended the Palestinian people and defended the interests of the people of Syria, that Syria was targeted from the very beginning. And so we want to, every war, every U.S. war is not for oil. The U.S. has blockaded and Cuba for years. Cuba has no oil and no great resources, but is determined to have its own independent policy and develop the country in the interest of the Cuban people. Now, this is also true in Syria. That determination to build a multinational, multi-religious, a mosaic of all the people of Syria for the benefit of the Syrian people and to use the resources for that. Syria accomplished great things. They had the highest educational and health standards in the entire region before this war. Mm-hmm. And this war has literally left, I think, a quarter of the population uprooted as both migrants internally and outside of Syria. That is a horrendous toll, and it's a toll that is how to create havoc. Every single U.S. war is never about construction. It's always about destruction.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left, so I got one question for both of you. William, you talked about Israeli aggression against Syrian Golan Heights. Tell us what Israel is doing there in northern Syria. In 1 minute, please.
It's just taking advantage of the last moments of a Trump presidency. They are slightly nervous about the incoming president-elect, Joe Biden. And of course, he's very pro-Israeli. He describes himself as pro-Israel and pro-Israel's interests. But he's a different kind of character from Donald Trump, who was almost, you could regard him as Israel's man in Washington. Donald Trump has been very extraordinary. Now, Biden's not going to take back the embassy from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv or do anything of that kind. He is very pro-Israel, but he isn't as blanket an actor as